welcome to Bonnets at Dawn, the show that explores the lives and works of women writers from the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries. I'm your host, Hannah Chapman.
And I am your host, Lauren Burke.
And this week is the last episode of our season on literature and race. In recent weeks, we've talked about Harriet Beecher Stowe a lot and her novel, Pink and White Tyranny.
We've talked about performative activism and anti-slavery bazaars of the 19th century.
We discussed Elle, Maria Child, Harriet Jacobs, Frances Harper, and Pauline Hopkins.
And we finally got to talk about Nella Larson and Passing, and I even managed to sneak an episode on Wuthering Heights in there.
But that is not it.
It's not it. It's not it. We're not done.
We still have this week, and it's a goodie. It's a good one, I promise. We're going to discuss two amazing and quite different pieces, My Contraband by our gal Louisa May Alcott, and The Half Cast, which is this episode's mandatory Broadview Press edition by Dinah Mullet Craik. Lauren, shall we kick things off with LMA?
Yes, let's. Okay. I just want to say that I am not going to introduce Louisa May Alcott to you all. One, because you've probably heard of her, probably heard of this gal. She's the author of Little Women. And, you know, we have discussed her quite a bit on this show. So if you want to freshen up your LMA history, I'd recommend checking out Season 2, Episode 8, Season 3, Episode 10, Season 4.3, Episode 4, and Season 4.4, Episode 8. There you go. Did you guys write all that down? I feel like there's more, but that's, you know, probably a good place to start.
I feel like that's maybe half, but
yeah.
Those are the direct.
Probably some of our favorite ones, yeah. I think. Who knows? There's
Who
surprises.
Knows? I can't remember which
I'm not
ones
sure.
there.
I can only remember one of those. So So what I am going to tell you today, however, is just like where Louisa was at this time in her life when she was writing this story. So My Contraband was first published in 1863 in The Atlantic, where you can still read it. I think you get about 5 free articles a month, so make this one of your articles. It was published as The Brothers and was written after Alcott served as a nurse in the American Civil War between 1862 and 1863 at the age of 30. Her service was cut short after she contracted typhoid fever, but it proved to be a great source of inspiration for Alcott. That's the upside to that.
The upside, yeah. It'll go in a book one day.
Right. And you can see both sort of, you know, play out in Hospital Sketches and My Contraband, which were written while recovering from her illness. And that experience was, you know, still just really fresh in her mind. Although Alcott survived typhoid, her health was ruined, in part from the illness and in part from the cure. So that was the mercury that they used to cure her.
Did they make you drink it? Do you know?
I think a pill or an ointment, but I'm not sure.
All I know about mercury is that if you set it on fire, it burns like real bright and it's poisonous.
It's poisonous.
So neither of those sound like good qualities for a medicine. Yeah, sorry. Derailing. The point of that is not mercury.
Mercury. The mercury did leave her suffering from chronic pain and contributed to her early death, sadly. Now, the story is told by Unionist nurse Dane, which I'm going to sometimes refer to her as Faith Dane because this character does turn up later in Alcott's fiction as Faith Dane. So the story is told by Faith Dane, who is asked to tend to a sick Confederate soldier who has severe typhoid. There we go. Alcott using that experience on the very first page. Nurse Dane is also given a freedman named Robert as an assistant, who she is deeply curious about. As the Confederate soldier begins to recover, Nurse Dane realizes that Robert is trying to undo all of her hard work. One night, after she falls asleep, Robert closes the window, shutting off fresh air to the soldier. He then locks the door and is about to kill him when Nurse Dane wakes up and confronts him. Robert explains to her that the two men are actually half-brothers and that the soldier named Ned was also Robert's former owner. And their backstory definitely gives me those Wuthering Heights and Tilney Hall vibes that we discussed last week, but with much more violence, as Ned has also kidnapped and raped Robert's wife, Lucy, who has then killed herself. Nurse Dane convinces Robert that he will meet his Lucy again in heaven, but only if he does not kill his brother. She then gives Robert some money so he can start anew. However, he decides instead to join the army, fight the rebels, and eventually he meets Ned in battle and kills him. Eventually, Nurse Dane and Robert meet again. She's still serving as a nurse, only this time Robert is the brother that she is caring for, and she learns that he has taken her name as a sign of their connection. More on that later. Robert then passes away.
Before we talk about that story, now that you've introduced it so well, Lauren, and laid the scene for us to discuss it, I'm going to introduce the next book, because I feel like they talk about such similar things, right? So I'm going to introduce novelist and poet Dinah Mullet Crank and her 1851 story, The Half-Caste, An Old Governess's Tale. So Dinah Mullet was born on April 20th, 1826 in Stoke-on-Trent, which is 45 miles south of Elizabeth Gaskell's Manchester. And another author connection is that Stoke-on-Trent is in the West Midlands, and that's the neighbouring county to George Eliot's Nuneaton. So kind of like similar geographic areas. These women were each born around 10 to 15 years apart, so they're not the same generation, but kind of they're spanning.
Close enough help? For me. That's close for me, actually.
I think
actually.
It goes Gaskell, Craik, Eliot. I think that's the order. At the age of 20, Craik's family moved to London. At 39, she married George Lilly Craik, and the pair adopted a little baby girl called Dorothy in 1869 when she was 43. In 1887, at the age of 61, Craik died of heart failure while preparing for her daughter's wedding. And I think her last words I read were like, oh, if only I'd lived four more weeks.
Yeah.
So sad. I think it's worth noting that Craik's father, Thomas Mullet, was a dissenter. He was a nonconformist minister. His wife, Dinah Craik, senior, worked with him as a schoolmistress, and Dinah Jr. assisted her mother at the school from the age of 13. Thomas didn't have the best mental health, and when Dinah Senior died, he abandoned his daughter and his three sons.
Oh, wow.
And so Dinah becomes the family's main breadwinner, and she supports herself and her siblings. And though she was trained as a governess, she actually supports them through her writing. She was a really prolific author. She wrote novels, ghost stories, stories for children, poems, essays, and a lot of her work is out there. And that reminds me of Frances Hodgson Burnett. Right? Because the family hits hard times and then she's writing to support all of her siblings. So I think the thing that's really interesting about Craik is just the similarities between all of these other all of these other authors, you know, which is interesting because then I think her writing is also really reflective of a lot of these authors. So
yes, totally. Yeah. I think if you, well, we'll get into it, but like, I like that you mentioned Gaskell because I'm like, you know what? I do think if you like Gaskell, then you'll also enjoy Craik as well.
I'm glad that we've come across Craik at this point and like to see all of those connections and see it play out in the writing and all of the similarities because I think you might miss it otherwise, right?
Totally.
Her relationship with her father is really interesting because his beliefs directly affected the family's income, like Bronson Alcott. Totally. And he was Irish, like the Brontes. So bear that in mind. Especially when we read The Half-Caste, because the way that Craik characterises Ireland, and especially the Lepore family in that story, Lepore is an old Irish Norman name, and by all accounts, she was a Francophobe like Charlotte Bronte and didn't like the Irish. So, yeah, the way that Ireland and the family are characterised, just, it does display that. A fun fact about her husband, he was a partner, or the and company, if you will, of the publishers Macmillan and Company.
Oh.
And we've all heard about that. I think he might have, like, co-founded it.
Okay.
He was definitely a partner there. So, and I think Macmillan was a publisher of hers. So,
makes sense. There you go. Makes sense.
If you'd like to know what she looked like, and I really recommend you look this up, there is my favorite author portrait ever on the National Portrait Gallery website. It's this amazing pencil portrait from 1845, and she looks so grumpy in it. She looks really pissed off. It's an immediate mood. I told Sam I want it as a print, and I showed him, and he was like, where would you put that? And I was like, above my desk. And he was like, you could just hang a mirror. Which I thought rude. Was rude. Yeah.
So, but you know what? I feel like you should just put it on your hearth, like a place of honor.
I might get a tattoo of it. I don't know. It really tickled me.
Oh my God, I need to look at it immediately.
So I'm going to leave this very brief bio here, but let's close out with Dinah Craik in her own words. Okay. They may find in a list of authors of the time that I, Dinah Maria Mulock, was born at Stoke-on-Trent in 1826. My very quiet life, completely out of the literary world, ought to be sufficient hint of how utterly I avoid and dislike personal publicity.
Amazing. She's like, don't come looking for me, guys.
All here's when Victorian I was born. Women are
here's
like,
where I was yeah. born. That's all you need to know.
It's big, like, burn my letters energy, right?
Oh, yeah.
So I'm going to give you the Broadview Press synopsis of the book, which after making Lauren read out that really in-depth description of My Contraband, this is not going to give you anything, so you will have to read it, sorry. The half-caste concerns the coming of age of its title character, the mixed race Zillah Lepore, daughter of an English merchant and an Indian princess. Sent back to England as a young girl, Zillah has no knowledge that she is an heiress. She lives with her uncle Lepore, his wife and two daughters, and is treated as little more than a servant in the household. Zillah's situation is gradually improved when Cassandra Pryor is employed as a governess to the Lepore daughters and takes an interest in the mysterious cousin. Craik explores issues of gender, race, and empire in the Victorian period in this compact and gripping novella. Very compact. Very, very gripping. Compact. Loved yeah. it.
Both of these are an afternoon read. Now, before we continue, I do want to add that the Broadview summary leaves out a very important character, and that character is Mr. Sutherland. He is our love interest, and I know he's going to get some airtime here today. So, quickly, Sutherland was a friend of Zillah's father, and he is her financial guardian. She lives with her family, her, you know, aunt, uncle, and cousins, but he's the guardian. And he's also friends with Cassandra and her family. And when Cassandra falls on hard times, he's the one that hooks her up with that governess gig. So, yeah, we're going to come back to all of that. So much to talk about. Okay. I guess I'm going to kick this off, our discussion off, by saying mm-hmm. why I wanted to discuss these pieces in particular. So, number one, as captain of Team Bronte, I just want to declare that both of these are Brontean texts, right? Like, the shadow of Jane Eyre and Wuthering Heights looms large see. Over both of these stories. Well, you have one that's about a governess, yeah. like, unraveling a family secret in the north of England.
And there's the classic, like, Bronte, she looks in the mirror, and all she sees is a plain woman staring back at her.
Yes, there's a lot of that in that story. And the other is about a man, you know, trying to exact revenge. Mm. And we'll get into that. More on that later. Number two, these are pieces about family and interracial relationships and how those bonds threaten the empire and just capitalism. Let's just go with capitalism on that one. And America, just what was going on in America at the time. Number three, they're both really, really political, aren't mm-hmm. they?
Yeah.
Like, everything we've read this season has been super political, starting with Pink and White Tyranny, mm. which all of that has been a response to, like, laws and policy. But set in a domestic sphere or like a female dominated space, which I think is really interesting. Now, I know we're going to jump back and forth between these two, but let's just start with Half Caste for a minute, because first things first, this novella is like ready for adaptation.
Yes.
It's like, it's kind of like The Woman of Color in the sense where it's like, it's giving you all of the pieces and it really needs to be fleshed out, and it can easily be fleshed out.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's giving you Cinderella meets Jane Eyre with like a dash of Mansfield Park. I know when Hannah and I first chatted about this book, you had said that it would be the perfect show for people like who really enjoyed, you know, Bridgerton season two and like, but wanted like more of the history, like wanted more realism. And I totally agree, because, you know, here instead of that Regency fantasy, you get sort of a gothic romance that's grounded in like a very real and very interesting history.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, even just a great read for Bridgerton fans and stuff, because of those Broadview Press like notes, the intro, the footnotes and the stuff at the back. Like, just reading it after watching it, it's like, okay. And also great if you, if you're like a people of color living in England before a certain time, Janaya, this book is for you.
Melissa Edmondson is the editor of the Broadview Press edition. Also, by the way, future guest, and she's amazing. More on that later on this year. So anyway, she is the editor of the Half Caste. She does an excellent job of giving you all of that history, all of that context in the introduction. And it is what sent me on a rabbit hole about the British East India Company this week.
Great.
Which I am not going to fully regurgitate here, because it would just like swallow the whole show. Don't worry. There are lots of dudes with podcasts about it if you really want to know more about it. So the you can find that, plays, that info.
The guy that plays, right, hear me out, tangent. The guy that plays Mr. Collins, what's his name? Come on.
Which Mr. Collins?
Oh, sorry. It's because I'm like seeing him. Little Mr. Collins.
Tom Hollander?
Little.
Yeah.
Pocket Collins. He is from the East India Company in Pirates of the Caribbean.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Right?
I think so. Yeah. Okay. Probably. Yeah. Good call. So many characters are. When you start learning about the British East India Company, you go, oh, it's connected to that. And oh, the tea that they dumped in the harbor in Boston. That was, yeah, it's all connected.
Sorry.
It's wild. In 1600, going back a ways, Queen Elizabeth I granted a charter to a group of English merchants that would let them travel to the East Indies on behalf of the crown in exchange for a monopoly on trade in the whole of Asia, as well as the Pacific. Wild. And this company was known as the Honorable Company of Merchants of London Trading with the East Indies, which is kind of a really long name.
It's snappy.
They ended up just being the East India Company, which we will refer to them probably as the British East India Company to differentiate between the Dutch East India Company, which was also equally terrible. So initially, they were on the hunt for spices, but over the course of its 258-year history, this expands to tea, textiles, porcelain, jewels, and opium. They were also involved in the slave trade. The East India Company was absolutely massive, and I don't think I really grasped like how massive it was until recently. So they had their own private army, which was like over 260,000 people at its height. Private army, a company with a private army. Imagine Amazon with a private army. And that private army was twice the size of just the regular English army. They also employed, you know, warehouse workers, clerks, sea captains, finance managers, factory workers. I mean, like, the list goes on and on and
so
on.
So literally other than the army, it could be Amazon.
Please. basically.
Okay.
And these jobs, especially those white collar gigs, right? Like, highly coveted. Mm-hmm. And you even had to pay a bond to work there. They were staffed, unsurprisingly, by white males. A lot of privileged white males, obviously, in those, you know, higher end jobs. And they were sent abroad and had many relationships with, you know, women of color in various places, especially in India. In fact, these relationships were encouraged with high class women so they could establish connections with wealthy families to further entrench the East India Company into their lives and into their businesses. So they could, you know, slowly creep in and start taking control. As we mentioned earlier, Zilla's parents are an Indian princess and an English merchant. Hannah, will you read this paragraph from an article entitled The Half Caste, A Tale Half Told by Kiran Mascarenhas?
In the 18th century, it was common for East India Company officials to cohabitate and raise families with Indian women. The most vivid recent account of this is William Dalrymple's White Mughals, 2002. Dalrymple chronicles the journey of Kitty Kirkpatrick, whose real-life story is remarkably similar to Zilla's fictional one. Both girls are born to aristocratic women of Persian descent and British men, and both assimilate successfully into English society by virtue of their wealth and mutable appearance, even though Anglicist ideas begin to replace Orientalist ones in their lifetime. By the mid-19th century, marriages between Britons and Indians of the upper classes were no longer given official sanction, a state of affairs hinted at by Mr. Lepore when he insinuates that Zilla is illegitimate.
So for a time, these relationships are encouraged and mixed race children, you know, move to England, they go to school, they marry into society, and then this causes a panic, right? And you start seeing restrictions against these unions and the children they produce, which, of course, didn't, you know, stop them from happening. A real life example that I think we've mentioned on the show before, but it was interesting to revisit, was Eliza Raine. So Eliza Raine was Anne Lister's first girlfriend. They met at boarding school in Yorkshire. Elizabeth was half Indian, and her father worked as a surgeon for the East India Company. And I was like, oh, when I remembered that, things started clicking. Last week, we talked about race in Wuthering Heights, and I think it would make a lot of sense if Heathcliff's mother was South Asian and his father worked for the East India Company. That would also make sense for like how he ended up in Liverpool.
Yeah.
Obviously, a port town.
Yeah, yeah.
Just throwing that out there. Last week you asked what might be different if Emily Bronte wrote Heathcliff as a woman, and I think we might find something like Zilla from The Half Caste.
Mm-hmm.
This mixed race child who is taken in by these white family members who, you know, abuse her and treat her like a servant. Of course, unlike Heathcliff, she can't leave and make an independent living, so, you know, she's trapped. Thankfully, Zilla is saved by her governess, Cassandra. One of the big similarities that the half-caste and my contraband share is actually that they are told from this perspective of these women who, I mean, they're white saviors, right?
Yeah.
To these characters of color.
They really do save the day.
They really do. And they're like very maternalistic. Mm-hmm. They're very moralistic. And they really, really objectify their charges, which I know we're going to get into. But overall, like, you know, what do you think of Cassandra or Cassia, her nickname?
So I love Cassia as a narrator. The way that she tells the story is very Wuthering Heights. And although it's written like she's writing the story down, but it has like this real strong sense of the oral tradition of like fairy tales and like passing these stories on to people, which I thought was really interesting, like how much of her voice comes through. Craik just does such a good job with the voice, and like it does, it feels like an actual person is telling you the story rather than this kind of distant narrator. Mm-hmm. And the thing that really stood out for me initially was the way that Cassie is just desperate for you to know that she has the original claim to Mr. Sutherland's affections, who is essentially like Zilla's guardian. Yeah. And she's just mm-hmm. like, you've got to know it. On the first page, there's a bit where she's like, oh, he looked affectionately at my mum and then he looked approvingly at me. Yes, approvingly, you know, mm-hmm. she like clarifies it. She's like, yes, I do mean that. He looks mm-hmm. at me in a different way. And then when Mr. Lepore questions her about her relationship with Mr. Sutherland, she blushes. She's so pleased that Mr. Sutherland called her like, I can't remember what it is, like her his special friend or someone that he yeah. really, you know, he really respects her. There's no one like her. She's just completely flummoxed by it. She's like, ah, me, when her mother describes him as a son. Yeah. So page one.
She's been friend zoned and she doesn't realize it.
Yeah. I thought it was a really clever way of kind of setting Cassie and Zilla up as rivals immediately. Mm-hmm. It does leave you wondering whether if Cassie's fortune had been better or if Zilla hadn't been beautiful and rich, would it have been a rivalry?
Totally.
Would Mr. Sutherland have gone with Cassie anyway? You know, it kind of feels mm-hmm. like she feels a bit snubbed.
Mm-hmm.
But never
Cassie,
says
it. Yeah, I mean, she's got a reduced circumstance, doesn't she?
Mm-hmm.
Which, Daddy yeah, failed she's a in governess. Business.
Yeah.
You know, she had to become a governess. So I think there's that little resentments there.
And she's
feel
not,
it.
She's younger than Mr. Sutherland, but not significantly mm-hmm. so. I think she's like 19 or 20, and he's 25. He's like mid-20s.
Yeah.
So it's not a huge difference. Whereas when she's 30, Zilla's 19. So the difference between right. Zilla and Mr. Sutherland is much greater. I wanted to share another bit from that really great essay, The Half-Cast, A Half-Told Tale. So, Lauren, can you read this bit out?
Zilla is not Mr. Sutherland's first love. He has, in the past, been engaged to an Indian woman with eyes like great oceans of light. And part of Zilla's attraction for him is that she reminds him of his time in India. So, yeah, I actually did think of Colonel Brandon initially when I read this in the story of like, oh, he had this past love. Zilla reminds him of her. She's much, much younger. He's also sort of like this very patient, older, guiding male force in her life. So I did think actually of Marianne and Colonel Brandon.
Yeah. So it is really convenient for Mr. Sutherland to fall in love with a vastly wealthy and beautiful young woman who mm-hmm. has just had a horrible experience with a dashing young man.
Absolutely.
And also, I think Mr. Sutherland weaponizes Cassia in a way. I've been trying to like figure out how to get it into words. I feel like I explained what I thought to you the other day and got it, but I'm struggling today. So I just have this sense that Cassia represents passive white women in a way,
mm-hmm.
because Cassia aids Sutherland in molding Zilla into the perfect wife, and she leads her into his arms. Kieran Mascanares says, Cassia, the Anglicist governess, is reminiscent of those missionaries who took the improvement of natives to be their calling.
Yes. The same attitude is in my contraband, like 100%.
There's all of the stuff where Cassia, like half of Cassia's battle isn't even with Zilla. It's not like teaching her places on a map, right? So in Mansfield Park, Fanny gets there and everyone's like, oh, she's so ignorant. But at the beginning, Cassia's like, this girl doesn't care about her appearance. And I think mm-hmm. it's important to remember like cleanliness is next to godliness, right? That was like huge. That would have been huge. So she's like, she doesn't look after herself. Like she doesn't take care of herself. She wears like dirty clothes, her clothes don't fit her, and it's like, well, I mean, she's being dressed in rags by this family who want to keep her in her place, like
mm-hmm.
and so her first bit is to kind of make her a woman before the education begins. So I know that you said The Half-Caste was a Bronteian text, but I gotta stake that claim for Austen, right? So we've talked about Mansfield Park a bit, we've talked about the Sense and Sensibility Colonel Brandon comparison. But I do think that if you read Agnes Grey as a response to Emma, then there is a spot for the half-caste in that pairing. There is something about the way that Mr. Sutherland works with Cassia to shape and improve his charge that really reminded me of Mr. Knightley and Mrs. Weston. If she hadn't married, like in my fanfic of Emma, Mrs. Weston is in love with Mr. Knightley and just ends up like watching it happen. I know that's nonsense. I just think it's like that. I've known you all of my life. Like, I'm the adult male. I've known you all of your life. I have like an invested interest in what happens with your money and your land. Also your mm-hmm. heart, let's get married. Mm-hmm. More so than the Mrs. Weston stuff.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, I also think the same thing is kind of happening in Sense and Sensibility as well, right? I mean, I think with Colonel Brandon almost maybe steering Eleanor to steer mm-hmm. Marianne.
Yeah.
So I think it's the same dynamic there.
He appeals to Eleanor all of mm-hmm. the time. Like, he's like, I'll go for Eleanor because Eleanor's on side. Eleanor gets it. And also people mm-hmm. initially are like, Eleanor and Colonel Brandon make sense.
Right. Right. Same. So I feel that dynamic very strongly there. Colonel Brandon also involved in the East Indies as well.
Yeah. The air was full of spices. He tells us. There we go. And then the other book that it reminded me of, and this might be like a wild card a little bit, was The Secret Garden. Mm-hmm. But that was mainly in the way that people are relating to Mary and Zillah and how in their neglect and unhappiness, they are perceived by everyone around them as ugly and unintelligent.
That makes sense. And what's funny is I had a different thought about The Secret Garden as I was reading this, which was like, oh my God, The Secret Garden would make so much sense and I think would be really improved upon in a way if Mary was a character of color.
Yeah, I agree.
If her mother was an Indian princess and 100%. Her father worked for the East India Company. I was like, this book.
Yeah, and it's funny because they just did that adaptation of it and they could mm-hmm. they could have, right?
Yeah.
It makes so much sense. Yeah. Cassia, much like Martha in The Secret Garden, eventually warms to her charge in spite of her alleged shortcomings. That said, I do think the shift from Cassia's first perception of Zillah to her blatant complicity in Sutherland marrying her and Craik setting her up immediately as a biased narrator does mean that we should be questioning Cassia's views and her motives. The only reason that Mr. Sutherland is seen as a deserving lover and not a groomer trying to steal Zillah's money like August Lepore is because Cassia is in love with him. So,
yeah.
And I think, when you question that, it's kind of similar to the way that you question Fanny Price and Mansfield Park as the narrator and the people that get a free pass in that. So,
mm-hmm.
It's such an interesting story. There is obviously so much more to say about it, to say about the history, to talk about the kind of devices and ways that Craik uses her writing to explore those topics. But we do have to talk about My Contraband some more, right?
Yeah, we do. We really do. And again, like so many thoughts. But let's start with the title. Because mm-hmm. that's just the first thing.
That's where you start, right?
That's where you start. So this was initially published as The Brothers, which is a very simple title, but I don't think it works for a couple of reasons. And one is that it blows the reveal that Robert, the biracial man who has escaped slavery, and Ned, the sick white Confederate captain, are brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And that reveal seems quite central to the story. It actually feels like it's supposed to be a shocking moment in the story, but you're kind of like, I already know because it's in the title, guys. So if I were Louisa's editor, I would have then just moved that reveal a little bit closer to the beginning of the story. And also I would have said, can you give us more of the brothers' backstory?
Mm-hmm.
The title, The Brothers, also implies that we're going to focus on the brothers that are on opposite sides of the color line, opposite sides of the war, and their fight over this woman named Lucy, who's Robert's wife. I would like to know more about that conflict. And I really would have liked for Nurse Dane to pull like a Nellie Dean and just really transport us there.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But the thing is, we aggressively stay in Nurse Dane's head as she is processing sort of every thought and every feeling she has about Robert. I mean, it kind of calls back to Passing and the way that Irene looks at and describes Claire.
Mm-hmm. That's a really good connection.
In a way, I think that, you know, My Contraband is actually a much, much more fitting title for the piece.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you guys do not know, contraband was a term commonly used in the U.S. military during the Civil War to describe a new status for people who had escaped slavery and then joined the Union forces. So they were thought of as contraband of war or captured enemy property. Many of these people became laborers to support Union efforts, and they were eventually paid wages, which is good. There were also these contraband camps that were set up near Union forces, and the Army helped to support and educate both the adults and the children. In 1863, Louisa toyed with the idea of going to Port Royal on Sea Island in South Carolina to teach at a contraband camp, which is where Charlotte Fortin was teaching the year before in 1862. So regular listeners will recall our episode on Charlotte Fortin and Louisa May Alcott back in season 4. Fortin was a Black diarist, educator, and activist. And what we did in that episode was we took a look at her diaries alongside Alcott's from the same period of time and just found that they were often circling each other. And here it is, like an almost meeting between the two of them, which I think is really interesting. So anyway, back to My Contraband, the story. The other reason why the title really works here, and I am going to quote from my copy of Alternative Alcott, which was edited by Elaine Showalter, who is a literary superstar historian and also responsible for the recovery of Diana Craig, which Craig might not be happy about, honestly, sounds like.
I don't think so. It doesn't sound like it.
So in the introduction to this collection of shorts by Alcott, Showalter says that while Alcott used the term contraband in a specialized Civil War sense, it also suggests the illegal or illicit sort of act of desire.
Mm-hmm.
Here, the nurse's repressed or contraband desire for the Black hero specifically. She goes on to say, in My Contraband, she uses the image of sexual and racial division as one side of Bob's face is deeply scarred while the other is magnificently handsome in its Saxon features and Spanish complexion.
What really struck me is how immediately Nurse Dane sexualizes Robert as well. And in that really specific way of constantly othering him, claiming ownership of him, and then patting herself on the back all at the same time, it's quite a feat. And it is clear that both My Contraband and The Half-Caste are exploring this theme of female desire in really interesting ways. And I'm glad that you explained the context for the word contraband, because even when it was published as The Brothers, that sense of illicit ownership is immediate. Just from the first page, one of the lines is, speaking of abolition reminds me that you can have a contraband for a servant if you like. It's that fine mulatto fellow who was found burying his rebel master after the fight and being badly cut over the head. Our boys brought him along. Will you have him? By referring to Robert as contraband, he is immediately transformed from a person, from a freed man, and back into an object. Mm-hmm. And this could be me not understanding enough about the American Civil War, but it was striking to me that it was a unionist doctor speaking like that, you know, asking if she'll have him. She obviously is like, sure, sounds great, extra pair of hands. And it reminded me of the efforts that Harriet Jacobs goes into in Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl to make it clear that Americans living in the northern states were as quick to abuse or go further in their abuse of enslaved and freed people.
Totally.
By the end of the story, Robert has taken Nurse Dane's name. He is going by Robert Dane when she re-encounters him. And even though he dies, and as far as Nurse Dane believes, is reunited with his wife Lucy in heaven, him taking that name is really interesting because he and Faith are together, but in the only way that this interracial relationship could be realized, with him being dead and penitent and her morally right. And also, like, they haven't had sex, so she's kind of, like, still pure.
Mm-hmm. Academic Bridget Fielder, who was actually mentioned on the show during our Woman of Color episode. We read a really great essay by her on that episode. She has written this book called Relative Races, Genealogies of Interracial Kinship in 19th Century America, which is really good, and it goes over, like, it goes over a ton of pieces that we actually read this season and about those interracial relationships reflected in literature. And she does kick off chapter 3 by discussing Alcott's abolitionist literature, in particular My Contraband, saying, by depicting relations of interracial kinship between Civil War soldiers, Alcott places the white military nurse Faith Dane in the position of mother to white, black, and racially mixed boys. Here, the white woman is the facilitator of the interracial kinship. The white and black brothers need not be in competition for Faith's love. She mothers her boys equally, standing in as a surrogate mother to the nation. The positioning of Faith Dane as a figure of interracial motherhood oddly forecloses her participation in interracial sex. The thing that would generally create such relations of interracial kinship in the first place. Alcott's story ultimately refuses to pursue an interracial romance plot, though it suggests its possibility, as Sarah Elbert and other readers of Alcott and race have suggested. Faith's desire is not restrained because of any general inclination against amalgamation, but is thwarted by, more specifically, her preoccupation with Robert's status as a previously enslaved person. At the moment in which Faith touches Robert and in an instant, the man vanished and the slave appeared. The construction of the difference in legal personhood rather than racialized appearance takes precedence. As Elbert notes, Alcott thus insists that it is the man tragically conscious of social boundaries and the consequences of crossing them who forces Faith Dane to see her whiteness.
I found on JSTOR, which is like our other obsession next to Broadview Press, honestly, a collection called Reading the Unwritten War Renaissance Tales. And it features passing, which obviously everyone remembers we talked about 2 weeks ago, alongside a few of Alcott's writings. So like My Contraband, ML, and An Hour. And in the introduction to that, Sarah Elbert says, Alcott associates mulatto fortitude and patience with life after death. Such an ending, I think, allowed her to name interracial rape, the violent punishment and exile Robert endured when defending his wife, and his powerful struggle for revenge. That lesson has much to do with the repression of African-American women's sexuality strategized by race leaders, including black club women, by the end of the 19th century, as Deborah Gray White argues. By then, the penalty for black men's defending black women's bodies was murder. It is a knowledge anchoring Irene Redfield's cool gentility, Brian Redfield's education of his sons and his longing for expatriation to Brazil, and it may explain some of the reasons for Claire's final escape.
Ooh, very good. I think it's funny also that both of us came to Elbert through different scholars. Just as a sidebar, Sarah Elbert is definitely cited quite a bit in Fielder's book, and she also has an Alcott bio that I actually just ordered this week. I haven't read it yet, but it's called A Hunger for Home.
I found the connection to passing really interesting, and something that really struck me with My Contraband was the explicit reference to Lucy's rape at the hands of Robert's brother Ned, within the story, and then like how that is starkly contrasted to that sexless union between Robert and Nurse Dane, like the graphic exploitation of the black women versus the very pure and like non-sexual connection between Robert and the white woman, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, as we've said already, the way that Nurse Dane thinks about and relates to Robert is anything but sexless. So yeah. She is not sexualized, but he is explicitly sexualized, as is his wife. She immediately objectifies him from the first furtive glances, you know, that she mm-hmm. throws his way. And this is like an abridged overview of their first meeting. I had seen many contrabands, but never one so attractive as this. All coloured men are called boys, even if their heads are white. This boy was 25 at least, strong-limbed and manly, and had the look of one who had never been cowed by abuse or worn with oppressive labour. His face was half averted, but I instantly approved the doctor's taste, for the profile which I saw possessed all the attributes of comeliness belonging to his mixed race. He was more quadroon than mulatto, with Saxon features, Spanish complexion, darkened by exposure, colour in lips and cheek, waving hair, and an eye full of passionate melancholy, which in such men always seems to utter mute protest against the broken law that doomed them at their birth. What could he be thinking of? My heart warmed to him at that idea. I wanted to know and comfort him, and following the impulse of the moment, I went in and touched him on the shoulder. And like, I know touching on the shoulder isn't sexual, but it's touch. It's like physical contact, like uninvited, unquestioned. She just goes in because of this mm-hmm. fantasy that she is creating about him. And the references to his Saxon features and his Spanish complexion remind me of the ways that Heathcliff's race is made ambiguous in Wuthering Heights. And it is as if Nurse Dane is distancing Robert from his own blackness and making her appreciation of him as a sexual object more palatable for a white audience.
Yeah, totally. It's interesting how that happens too, in a way, in Half Caste, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like at first, the way Cassandra is sort of repelled by Zilla.
Mm-hmm.
And then over time, like she just keeps like... She's looking at her and she's like thinking about her in sexual terms and almost like coming to terms with like the fact that maybe like her beauty standards are not right. She's like, oh, wait, well, even though her, you know, skin is not white, she's still, wow, she's so beautiful. And wow, look at the way her dark hair looks against the crimson pillow. And yeah, it's really about these people and their own ideas of race versus the actual like people of color in the story. Like it's really them like grappling with themselves a lot of the story.
But I think, you know, Dinah Craik and Louisa May Alcott, as well as intentioned as they may be, they're white women, you know, and the white 100%. Woman is fully censored in both of these stories. These are tales mm-hmm. about white women's ideas about race.
Totally. I mean, it's funny. On one hand, my big critique of like both stories is that the people of color are, you know, very flat. They're absolutely objectified. And we don't have enough of them or their voice. But like, on the other hand, I'm so glad that both authors didn't try to write from the perspective of a person of color, because I just don't think that they would have been able to pull it off.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think they're more successful because of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like, you know, you read them and it's not like I love the way that Cassia is written and I love kind of existing in her head for the hour and a half it takes to read the book, but it's not, you're not like in support of either right. Faith Dane or Cassia. And I don't know if that's because I'm reading it in 2022 or if that's the intention. Like it is hard to mm-hmm. tell, you know, and I think with Alcott, I think it's more likely that it's sincere. I'm just thinking about like her representations of like freed people and African Americans within some of her other stories and, you know, the way that she characterizes race in her stories. I think that she was an abolitionist. I think that she had a lot of good intentions, like those mm-hmm. 19th century anti-slavery bazaars. But yeah, like...
Well, I also find it very curious that this is not her only story about a white woman sort of grappling with her desire of with her desire for a man of color. Mm-hmm. I think that's interesting that it's like a repeated theme.
Yeah, absolutely.
We'll have to revisit that at another time with her, honestly. But
get HBS to do another seance. We'll do a seance for Harriet Beecher Stowe. We'll get her to hit up Alcott. Because woman's private, you know. I feel like she might not respond
She's
to
not
us.
Answering.
She might respond to the ghost of Harriet Beecher Stowe. Maybe.
And that's all we have for this week and this series. We'd like to say another big, big, big thank you to all of the amazing guests who have joined us, including Felicia Gabrielle, Caritha Mitchell, Yuri Don, Brian Sweeney, and Lydia Craig. Okay, just because this series is over, that doesn't mean that it's going to be the last that you'll hear from us, because we're going to be back. We have more episodes this year that are in the works right now, including more mixtapes and a read-along that Hannah has picked. She's making me read a book.
It's not Middlemarch, guys. Calm down. I wouldn't do that to anyone.
That's your hint. It's not Middlemarch.
No, it's the Cats Poems by T.S. Eliot.
yeah.
Can you imagine?
Honestly,
the only book by a man I've read.
If they were written by a woman, she would have, like, you would have made us read them for the podcast. So
100% I would.
Well, if people want to find out what this read-along is, you know, we're going to put that on the internets. Mm. Hannah, where can the people find that on the internets?
You can find us, as always, on Instagram and Twitter. If you're lucky, Lauren might even share that Dinah Craig portrait. On one of those.
Oh, I'm gonna. 100%.
You can find us at, you can email us at bonnets@dawn@gmail.com. You can join our lively discussion group on Facebook by searching for, you guessed it, Bonnets at Dawn. And you can buy our book, Why She Wrote, in English and now in Spanish, wherever you get your usual literary fix.
Thank you guys for listening, Bye. Sharing, commenting, and love you. Bye. Thank you.